On, so I'd like to call the Committee on Healthcare to order. At this point, the chair of the committee is testifying in another committee, so we're going to move a bunch of Senate bills that. What?
She's in a meeting.
Damn, she got here too soon. We're just going to move a bunch of Senate bills, Lori, so.
2028. Lori, but before you start,
right.
If you look at it, it's
okay. Perfect. I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to look. I've been running flat. Yeah.
Go sit down. We're under control.
No, we're not.
Are we already in?
We're in. Oh, we just haven't done anything because I was going to do Senate bills, and then you showed up.
Good grief. Okay, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2028A. Zena.
House Bill, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2028A directs the State Board of Pharmacy to adopt rules that permit pharmacists to engage in the practice of clinical pharmacy. It permits health insurers to provide payment or reimbursement for services provided by the pharmacist through the practice of clinical pharmacy or pursuant to the statewide drug therapy management protocol. It limits the participation from practitioner to physician. It adds the Oregon Health Authority and coordinated care organizations to reimburse pharmacists or pharmacies under specified situations. It states that for this statute, a pharmacist is classified as a primary care provider. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no amendment and no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, so is it Corey Hewitt and Nikki Terziev, are you the first ones? Okay, please come forward.
I had a short PowerPoint.
You
want to
sit here? You want me to click?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Never give Nikki the clicker.
Yeah.
I'm a responsible clicker. I'll just start us off, if I might. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Nikki Terziev here on behalf of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition, which is really made up of two different pharmacy associations, health systems-based and then Main Street community-based. And we've come together over the last few years and worked rather hard on getting to this point. And House Bill 2028, as you've heard through the preview from staff, is a bill that will allow for clinical pharmacy services. These are pharmacy services that a pharmacist can conduct practicing at the top of their license as a collaborative partner post-diagnostic on now a team of pharmacists or a team of physicians can work together to help serve patients in a more cost-effective manner. Corey Hewitt has done a great job and has been in front of this committee before having this discussion. We're very pleased to be back now, and hopefully we'll be able to move this bill.
Thanks, Nikki. Madam Chair, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to come and testify. As you recall, maybe a year ago about this time, we did a lengthy conversation around this concept. My colleagues, Stacy Ramirez and Josh Bishop, they're unable to be here, but I wanted to just really kind of tee up the
your name.
My name is Corey Hewitt. I'm here representing the state of Oregon, Oregon Pharmacy Coalition, and the pharmacists of Oregon. So just really briefly, just to kind of tee up the problem and the situation that we have and why this bill is important. So I have a short presentation. In 2007, there was a statement issued by the Institute of Medicine that really outlined that pharmaceuticals are the most common medical intervention. And with that, as you guys are well aware, pharmaceuticals do a great amount of good. There's now treatments for cancers, there's cures for hepatitis C, but at the same time, those medications can cause harm. As molecules become more complex, pharmacists are uniquely trained and positioned in the marketplace to take advantage of such, and so that's why we're here for this legislation. In addition, in 2015, just recently in January, another study was published and by the National Governors Association in 2015, and really what they outlined is really that was titled "The Expanding Role of Pharmacists in a Transformed Healthcare System," and really what that addressed is that pharmacists are uniquely positioned to work atop their license and really work in conjunction with the part of the healthcare team with physicians, nurses, PAs, and NPs to really take a holistic approach to the care of the patient. In addition, that study also indicated that over 50% of adults in this country have a chronic disease, which expands over 117 million people. Another statistic that was staggering was the average number of medications per capita has increased over the last 10 years from 10.1 to 12.6. And as we address the cost of these medications, the cost avoidance or the cost of all medication-related problems exceeding $290 billion a year, which is 13% of the healthcare expenditure, and which also contributes to almost 1.1 million deaths. In addition, a study that was very large and conducted over 15 years, the Surgeon General reported on over 30,000 patients, the ROI of what these services are. So these services have been traditionally done in pockets, in nationally, in health systems, for example. I once managed a large anticoagulation clinic, which was very successful. So these services have been done, but the reason why this legislation is in front of you today is really to expand and eliminate some barriers to such. So on a national basis, the demonstrated ROI of 5.1. In addition, my colleague Josh Bishop, who presented last year, unfortunately cannot be here today. They've been doing these services from a health plan perspective, and they've seen ROI anywhere between 2 to 1 to 8 to 1. And Josh would say that the importance of having these clinical pharmacists on a part of their teams and interacting with physicians and making sure patients are getting the right meds at the right time is these face-to-face visits. And I really believe that's an important aspect of it. If you think about the non-traditional dispensing role of a pharmacist, this really takes the pharmacist and lets them sit down with the patient in a one-on-one perspective. And the ROI has been demonstrated there as well. So this defines the clinical pharmacy service. I'm not going to read to it, but I really want you to understand that this is part of a post-diagnostic care team where it's a non-dispensing role. I just mentioned that if you can think about the concept of taking a patient and a pharmacist sitting in an exam room in conjunction with a physician in their office, that's really what we're talking about here. So I wanted the members of the committee to understand that this is a non-dispensing role. And so this is the final slide, and really what it wants you to illustrate is there's four major parts of the bill. What it does, the one major aspect of the bill is it defines the clinical pharmacy practice, okay? And I've kind of did that in the same sentence on the last slide. It really illustrates it's a post-diagnostic disease state management. It could be MTM, medication management therapy, under protocol with physicians in conjunction with the healthcare team. In addition to that, it really outlines the clinical pharmacy service agreement. What that does, it allows pharmacies or pharmacists to engage in CCOs, ACOs, or other physician groups and have these conversations around what that would look like. So if we wanted to tackle hypertension, for example, we'd sit down with an organization and we'd outline the training requirements, we'd outline the treatment protocols, and then we'd finally outline maybe the reimbursement or the reimbursement contract arrangements in that clinical pharmacy agreement, okay? So that's outlined in the bill as well. Another big part of the bill is expanding the statewide protocol. And really what we're trying to accomplish here is expand on the 10-year success that we've had in a public health of pharmacists doing immunizations. And so California last year passed two very similar legislation, but expanded that in collaboration with the Oregon Health Authority and obviously physicians and pharmacists throughout the state, looking at potentially expanding to such things as smoking cessation, travel medications, and oral contraceptives. So that provision is in there as well. And then finally, as many as you may or may not know, pharmacists are one of the only healthcare providers that are not recognized as providers in statute. So what this allows us to do is recognize us in the state of Oregon as providers. It also allows for payment of our services for these cognitive clinical pharmacy services that we're talking about. It's one thing I do want to make for on the record that this is not a mandate for payment. It allows us, though, to then have those conversations and really be able to come scale these services as we move forward in healthcare transformation. So with that, we'll open it up for a discussion.
I'd like to ask some questions, and I'm going to be referring to whether this is really expanding the scope of pharmacists for clinical pharmacy agreements. Is it? It's not intended to.
Not a scope of practice change. No.
It is not intended for that. All right, but it expands the opportunity for the pharmacist to enter into these agreements.
Correct. Currently in rules at the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, it defines one of these collaborative practice agreements between a physician and a patient and a pharmacist. It's very restrictive. This just broadens that concept. So a group of patients, a group of pharmacies or pharmacists, and a group of physicians could enter into these contracts.
So on page 3, lines 41 and 42, that's where they're defining clinical pharmacy. It says the provision of patient care services, including but not limited to post-diagnostic disease state management services. What does that include? What does that even mean? It seems like it's a pretty broad statement.
Sure. So what post-diagnostic means is, as pharmacists have traditionally in health systems, and quite frankly, when I mentioned the COAG clinic, say that a patient has been diagnosed with atrial fibrillation and now needs warfarin. That patient is then referred to a pharmacist clinic. So that is the post-diagnostic clinician. From that, the pharmacist sits down and engages in a protocol and discussion around their medicines and adjusts those medicines based on the protocol that has been agreed upon through the physician or national guidelines, and et cetera. Does that help? I mean,
yes, it does. It's services that the provider and you are already providing. I mean, you're providing with agreements, right?
Right.
So the intent is not to open the scope.
No.
Of practice for pharmacists.
Correct.
I just want to make sure that that's it.
Clear, very
I'm
good question.
A yep. bugaboo on scope of practice.
Yeah, this is not a scope of practice change. Like I mentioned, these services have been provided in pockets. Like I said, the current rules are pretty restrictive. What this allows us to do is just have those broadened expansions to help our patients, such as a CCO and their patient population, not just a patient.
Great. Other questions? You're being let off easy.
Well, it's because you did such a good job asking
you
the questions
did.
I was going to ask.
That's great. All right. All right. Let's get Jessica Adamson, Tom Holt, Jeremy Vandehey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here with Providence Health and Services. We're just here to lend our voices in support of this legislation. Clinical pharmacy services represent an opportunity to help improve patient outcomes in a world where medication management is increasingly complex, as there are more medications available for a wider range of conditions. Using pharmacists to help in the care team manage those medications and really improve patient experience and patient outcome is really important and leads towards the triple aim. This bill, as it's been negotiated, is an important step forward and one that we support.
Chair Montes Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandehey with Kaiser Permanente. I also want to echo Kaiser's support for this bill. Don't have a lot to add on the description of what it's done. I think you've heard enough on that. But I would say, as an integrated system, we try to do the best we can to include our pharmacists as part of the care team now. Our pharmacies are actually in our same clinic buildings, and they're connected with the same EHR. But we're more restricted in Oregon right now than we are in Washington in terms of the types of agreements that we can the framework that we can create for to include pharmacists as part of the care team. So this is really going to create an alignment on both sides of the river, so we can basically do what we're already doing in Washington on the Oregon side.
Chair Montes Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. Also pleased to be here in support of this bill as it now stands. We're happy to be able to work with the Pharmacy Coalition on the House side and get this to a good place. We do think this is a really good opportunity to improve care involving prescription drugs, and as was testified, expanding the locations or points of access where people really can get good management of what are increasingly complex medication regimens. Some wonderful developments that have happened in recent years in terms of the things that are available, but it's also created a lot of complexity in care. And I think it is important to note that this is not a scope of practice change. in certain settings. These kind of protocol approaches as part of a team have been available for years. A clinic that I personally go to on a regular basis operates exactly that way. It's a very well-established practice, and we're looking forward to working with pharmacies and pharmacists in developing contracting models that can help this to really work well. We know that there have been some other conversations around another scope issue, and I think that's a separate conversation in as far as treading into prescribing. This bill is not doing that. We have no view on the other issue at this point. So we're really pleased to be here in support of this. We think it's a great step forward.
Great. Questions? All right, so don't leave the room unless you have to testify somewhere else, because this is just a public hearing, and there is an amendment that we're going to sort of talk about, because this is such a good bill, I don't want to muck it up. But with that, I'd like to call up Jim Gardner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for Pharma, and it honestly kind of pains me to say that we have to express some opposition to this bill. We have worked collaboratively over the years on many successful projects with pharmacists. They are clearly an indispensable part of the healthcare community, and there's a great deal of good in this bill with which we agree, in particular the provisions that that make pharmacists providers so that they can get paid adequately for the valuable services they provide. And I'm not going to go through the written testimony in detail, but I want to just draw your attention to what we think are perhaps some unintended drafting issues, which, if not expansions of the scope of practice, are something that really deserve your careful scrutiny. And one, Madam Chair, is the provision that that you noted, page 3, lines 41 through 42. And I heard the testimony that it was not intended as a scope of practice expansion. And I take that to be an accurate characterization of the intent. But if you look at the actual wording, the actual cold, hard, black and white wording, it says, including but not limited to, and that's not a limiting phrase. And then if you look over on page 5, lines 14 through 16, and this is the provision that currently authorizes vaccines and would be extended to authorize the provision of patient services, including smoking cessation therapy and travel health services. And that, again, is not a limiting phrase, including, so that you've really opened up, I think, quite a broad area there, perhaps unintentionally, but the way that the Oregon Supreme Court reads statutes, they read the text and the context of the actual wording as the primary guide to interpretation. So I simply want to call that to your attention, Madam Chair, the same provision that you noted, and then the one on page 5.
Thank you. And you know, in my interpretation, I mean, this is all based on a clinical pharmacy agreement between a pharmacist and a provider. I don't know if the proponents want to come and address this particular issue.
May I address that particular issue? The language on page 5 is an OHA protocol, and then fleshed in by rules of the Board of Pharmacy. So that's a different sort of, you know, different kind of issue than what you have said, Madam Chair, which is accurate for the other portion. But the page 5 language is different. That's an OHA protocol, and then fleshed in by board rules. So that's the same kind of service authorization as we currently have for vaccines.
Well, we certainly can put on the record, and I think OHA is in the room, that the intent, of course, is not to expand the scope.
Madam Chair, I think that's not the intent, but the actual wording is not words of limitation. It's including. So that's just for your consideration.
No, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Okay. All right. Any questions? Golly, this is so easy. Now, we do have the Dash 5 amendments. Zena, are you prepared to sum them up, or should we just... Yeah, okay, we don't have it. So I think it's been Senator Steiner Hayward that is adopted or been working on this with Representative. And what it would allow is the pharmacist to administer oral hormonal contraceptives that have been prescribed and dispensed. I am not the one to really explain this amendment. But
Madam Chair, if I may, I don't think we're actually quite ready to talk about this today. Okay. There's been a lot of questions about exactly how best to frame this, and we're working with a lot of interested stakeholders. And with your permission, Madam Chair, we'd like to postpone the conversation on this amendment until a future date when we're ready to reconsider this bill. Is that acceptable
Absolutely.
To you, Madam Chair? Thank
Absolutely.
You. I think that we'll be able to present a more coherent
And
conversation
I've heard that there
point.
May be another bill.
Yeah.
And I would rather not muck this one up if there's another bill
we have options, and I think, Madam Chair, it's probably best for everybody if we just leave it at that for the moment.
That
Thank
sounds
you.
Good to me.
Yeah, Madam Chair, both Senator Steiner Hayward and I are on that work group, and we will get to a resolution one way or another and relatively soon. So,
yeah, we'll deal with it.
Senator
Thank
Shields.
You.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am concerned that when that topic, which is a very big policy shift, happens, that if it gets done just in the Rules Committee and that it's not in consideration of the Health Care Committee, that would trouble me. So I hope that we will have a long discussion about what the literature says about this topic mm-hmm. in this committee, even if it's going to be going somewhere else.
Madam Chair, my understanding is that this would be coming from If it came in another vehicle, it would come from House Rules, and then it would come to this committee on this side. So we would have an opportunity, Senator Shields, to have that conversation in the Health Care Committee. And Representative Buehler and I, who are doing the primary work on it, have been really pushing hard to develop significant literature and understand the background for this, and working with a range of organizations that care deeply about ensuring access to women's health care. So
what I do want to make sure that I don't want to rush any big policy through here without making sure that all of the stakeholders have had a chance once the idea comes forward for them to be able to look at it and see how it affects their organizations.
I can assure you, Madam Chair, that we have been involving stakeholders closely, and Representative Buehler and I are both having significant conversations with anybody who's we think might be vaguely interested in this at the moment. So I can assure you that we're not trying to rush anything or exclude anybody from the conversation. Thank you.
Madam Chair, just to back up what Senator Steiner Hayward said, we will have ample opportunity to vet the issue in this committee.
Thank you very much. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2028A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2294.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2294A requires the Oregon Health Authority to establish the Oregon Health Information Technology Program. It authorizes OHA to provide optional health information technology services to support statewide health care and establish fees to cover the cost of expanding the health information technology services. It allows OHA to participate and fund partnerships or collaboratives. It establishes the Health Information Technology Oversight Council under the Oregon Health Policy Board. It changes appointment authority from the governor to the Oregon Health Policy Board and modifies the role of the council to provide strategic and policy recommendations. It expands OHA's scope to include certain activities in support of the program. It clarifies procurement procedures and requires that OHA submit an annual report to the Legislative Assembly. There is a -A2 amendment which removes Oregon Health Authority exemption relating to information technology under the Department of Administrative Services and modifies the operative date. There's no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued.
Great. All right. We only have two people signed up for this. It's Susan Otter and Greg Van Pelt.
Hi, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Susan Otter, and I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm pleased to present testimony today in support of House Bill 2294A, which supports the health information technology efforts we have at the Oregon Health Authority. Health information technology includes tools such as electronic health records and doctor's offices, electronic methods for sharing information across providers and coordinating care, analytic tools to assess outcomes and quality, and electronic tools and applications for patients to better manage their own health health care and outcomes. These types of tools are critical to support new models of care coordination, accountability, and payment as Oregon continues to embrace the coordinated care model. House Bill 2294A updates the current statute that we're operating under at the Oregon Health Authority related to health IT. Oregon's current statute was established in House Bill 2009 and set forth a role for the Health Authority as a strategic policy and coordinating role and established the Health Information Technology Oversight Council, or HITOC. HITOC provides a stakeholder forum for strategic planning, identifying policy issues and removing policy barriers, measuring our progress as a state for how we're doing in health information technology, and providing transparency over the health information technology efforts we have in the state. Since 2009, a considerable amount of new work has been undertaken at the Oregon Health Authority related to health IT, and considerable new federal investments in health information technology have taken place. House Bill 2294A updates our current statute to recognize that new work and that new funding. The bill does three things. First, it requires OHA to maintain and establish and maintain the Oregon Health IT program. This program would encompass work that's already in place or underway within the OHA's Office of Health Information Technology. It provides clear authority for us to continue this work to serve all Oregonians, not just those that are covered by Medicaid or other OHA programs. The bill describes the types of activities OHA may engage in to administer the Oregon Health IT program, including setting fees for the sustainability of any services included in this program. The bill does not require OHA to pursue any specific health IT services, but clarifies that any services we do provide are to support healthcare stakeholders across the state, and not just for Medicaid or other OHA programs. The second thing that the bill does is it provides OHA the flexibility to enter into partnerships or collaboratives where other entities in Oregon are establishing statewide health IT infrastructure and tools. The bill allows for OHA to enter into agreements with respect to partnership participation and funding in these partnerships or collaboratives, to establish the role of the state to represent the state and Medicaid interest in such a partnership or collaborative, and ensure that we can participate formally in governance of any sort of partnership. We do see partnerships and collaboratives are forming across healthcare stakeholders, including OHA in the state, and Greg Van Pelt is here to talk about one such collaborative that we're supporting. And then lastly, the bill pulls the Health IT Oversight Council under the Health Policy Board to ensure alignment with the goals and efforts of the Health Policy Board to support health system transformation broadly in Oregon. So I'd like to have Greg talk about one of the partnerships that we've been participating in, and then I'll come back and talk about the -2 amendments.
Thank you, Susan, and good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Greg Van Pelt. I presently serve as president of the Oregon Health Leadership Council. I'm speaking today in support of House Bill 2294 as it relates to the work of OHLC and is now managing in partnership with the Oregon Health Authority and its Office of Health Information Technology. The Emergency Department Information Exchange, or what we refer to as EDI, is a web-based communication technology that allows emergency departments to communicate about patient visits in real time. This technology allows emergency department clinicians to identify patients with complex care needs who frequently use the emergency department for their care and who would better be served or be better served in a different setting. EDI improves communication among hospital emergency departments. It also provides the foundation for real-time delivery of crucial medical information to providers and others interested in the patient's care. The tool allows the hospital event data housed in EDI to be pushed to health plans, CCOs, provider groups on a real-time basis for their specified member or patient populations. Once notified, providers can use EDI to access care guidelines and other vital information to better understand the patient's health situation. This translates into a better understanding of an emergency department patient's condition and improved care coordination once they leave the emergency department. In 2013 and 14, OHLC worked with the Health Authority, the Hospital Association, the American College of Emergency Physicians in Oregon, emergency department staff, and other community partners to implement EDI across the state. The EDI utility, as we refer to it, is a three-year pilot financially supported by 11 commercial health plans. The Health Authority, on behalf of 16 or all 16 CCOs and all 59 Oregon hospitals except for the VA at this time. It's governed by the EDI Utility Governance Committee, whose members represent CCOs, commercial health plans, hospitals, emergency physicians, medical groups, and the Hospital Association. The Health Authority is co-sponsor of the utility. It provides staff support and is participating as an ex officio member of this governance committee. As Susan mentioned, with passage of 2294, the Health Authority would become a formal or could become a formal voting member. The partnership was critical in launching the first phase of this effort. It provided leadership, staff support, and matching grant funding to obtain the commitment of hospitals across Oregon. As we moved into the EDI utility and sought broad support across all stakeholders, the Health Authority led the coordination and outreach to all CCOs in the state to obtain their support. And finally, the Health Authority obtained federal match to provide the Medicaid share of funding to sustain the EDI utility operation for 3 years to prove its value. In terms of the future, this really is just the first of many opportunities to work together. As our stakeholders continue to adopt risk-sharing relationships, it will be critical for them to rely on technology tools such as EDI to support critical transition from hospital care to manage population health and coordinate care across sectors and account for health care outcomes. Hospital 2294 provides both practical and strategic authority to OHA to advance these types of partnerships. Thanks for the opportunity to provide testimony on this important topic.
Questions?
Go ahead, Madam Chair.
Pardon?
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I apologize.
No, that's okay. I would like to know about the MMIS system, how that fits into this bill, any other IT programs. Whenever we talk about IT and OHA, I get nervous. And so... Is there a relationship between OHA and DAS? So if you could
Great.
Address those two.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the MMIS is our Medicaid Management Information System that is the technology system underlying the operations of the Medicaid program. That system is operated within the Department of OHA through our contractor and does not have anything to do with the health information technology work that we do in the Office of Health IT. The scope of our work relates to care coordination, analytics relating to clinical information in patient records to ensure that our care teams have the right patient information at the time of care across the care continuum, that our CCOs, health plans, health systems, and providers have the right aggregated clinical data to look at quality outcomes and to manage their populations, and that patients and Oregonians have the right access to their own patient information to better engage in their care. The MMIS and those systems are really around operating our Medicaid program and are very separate. The relationship between the Oregon Health Authority and DAS as it pertains to oversight of contracting and IT projects is very spelled out. The amendment that is for this bill, the Dash 2 amendments, do some work to make sure that we're in alignment with Senate Bill 7, which pertains to ensuring that DAS has the authority over all contracting and removes some exceptions for OHA. So the Dash 2 amendments simply remove a portion of this original bill that's not necessary and would be out of alignment to ensure that we're in alignment. So for example, all of the contracts and IT projects that we have in the health authority must go through our DAS oversight process and the state CIO process.
Yes, thank you. And it might be helpful to the committee if I were to explain that also. This is a subject we've been talking about in the Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means, mm-hmm. and you'll note that this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means as well. And all of, thank you so much. All of these, I'm starving. I'm sorry. This is my mid-afternoon crash. All of these IT projects are now basically, and things like this are now going through the IT Subcommittee of Ways and Means and then on to the subsequent more policy, if you will, topic-specific based subcommittee. So they're getting lots and lots of oversight. Anything that's related to IT in any way, shape, or form is getting lots and lots of oversight. And these are exactly the kinds of questions we need to be asking and are being asked as part of the Ways and Means process as well. So it doesn't mean we shouldn't ask them here. I'm just adding some depth, perhaps, to the conversation. Ms. Otter has been before the subcommittee several times already, and I know we'll be coming again soon. I'm sure.
Thank you. What about the all claims, all payer database? And is how does this system affect that one? Of course, that isn't real time
data. Sure. Madam Chair, thank you. The all payer, all claims database is claims and administrative and encounter data, and that is operated out of our health analytics division with the support of the Office of Information Services within OHA. That is outside the scope of the health IT program, which is focused on clinical data. However, the two are related as we think about using clinical data to assess outcomes and look at moving towards clinical metrics to assess how we're doing in health system transformation. So, for example, three of our CCO incentive pool metrics are related to clinical data that come from electronic health records, and that's within the purview of the health IT program to have the ability to collect that data. The All Payer, All Claims database then produces the data that supports metrics and transparency based on claims and administrative data.
So there could be, you may be getting information from the All Claims, All Payer database.
Madam Chair, OHA leverages the All Payer, All Claims database to produce all of our metrics, many of our metrics and data. It's that data is claims-based data. The clinical data that we'd like to all move to have clinical-based outcomes metrics is something that we're looking at building the tools to make sure we can collect those data so that we can also be producing those. So they're really partner efforts, and we work very closely with the Office of Health Analytics on all the work that we do.
And one final question I have, what about HIPAA compliance mm-hmm. With sharing of data between everybody? How is that being handled?
Sure. So, Madam Chair, the HIPAA compliance is something that all of our efforts and the efforts that we support must comply with HIPAA. And so we endeavor to engage our Department of Justice, who are HIPAA experts, in any contracts that we engage in, any work that we're participating in to ensure compliance with HIPAA and other privacy regulations.
Okay. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, we all want to be focusing on more mental health and drug and alcohol treatment, and we've always had problems with releases, et cetera, and sharing of data, and I assume you'll be dealing with that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. BJ Kavnar.
Good Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is B.J. Kavanaugh. I serve as executive director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are the collaborative for people living with chronic health conditions in Oregon. I come before you today as the former vice chair of HITOX Legal and Policy Committee, which I had the opportunity of co-chairing with Gwen Davis. And to speak to the importance of this work, this was something that was in many ways for me an entree into a larger world of healthcare policy. And the work that we did was so very necessary in trying to make sure that we were putting the policies in place, allowing everyone to communicate, allowing patients to communicate with their providers, providers to communicate with other people, while still being compliant of HIPAA and specially protected health information. So I just would like to encourage you to move this bill forward. It's an incredibly important bill for the infrastructure, the minutia that never gets seen, but that we couldn't exist without in the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I'll close public hearing on House Bill 2294 and open a work session on House Bill 2294.
I'm trying to move the dash A2 amendment in the House Bill 2294.
Senator Cruz moves the dash A2s into House Bill 2294. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2294 as amended by the dash A2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2294 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Pell?
Aye.
Senator
Shields?
Aye. Senator Steinhardt?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And anyone like to carry this bill? I will do it then. And I closed it, right? House Bill 2294. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2369.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2369A requires the Department of Human Services to establish by administrative rule the responsibilities of a case manager who receives notice of a life-sustaining procedure for an individual for withholding or withdrawing those life-sustaining procedures. It requires the notification to the person designated as the healthcare representative of any knowledge, documentation, or other information be included in the administrative rule. There is no amendment and no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Great, thank you. Bob Judith, you're the only one to sign up. My goodness. Hopefully you're for the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Judef. I'm the Director of Disability Rights, or again, we are for the bill. The reason that this bill has come before you is that when ORS Chapter 127, our advanced directive laws were put into place many years ago, there was part of that law was designed to address end-of-life decision-making. The advanced directive, of course, is a vehicle by which individuals can give directions for how they want health decisions to be made if they are unable to make those decisions for themselves. However, a person may become unable to make their own decision without having an advanced directive, and then the question is, how does a physician proceed to make a decision when it seems appropriate to end life supports? What the Oregon law does is it provides a safe harbor for physicians to follow in order to obtain informed consent for the maintenance or withholding of end-of-life types of supports. And what it does in that provision of the law is it lists there's a priority list of individuals who can provide consent for that process if they can be found. And then the law goes on to explain that that whoever is the person to give informed consent should consult with other interested parties. And then it specifically says that if an individual who about whom a decision is being made has a case manager
state case manager, that state case manager should be notified of that a decision is being made. The purpose of that provision, and I was around when that was inserted into the law, the purpose of the provision was to make sure that for individuals with disabilities who may present very unusual circumstances to a medical practitioner, for example, unusual physical aspects of their lives or intellectual disabilities, that the practitioner has as much information as possible so that and the decision maker has as much information as possible so that an appropriate decision can be made. In Oregon, over the years, our office has received many calls in these situations. I would say we receive anywhere from 2 to 5 a year, usually having to do with a person with an intellectual developmental disability who poses an unusual situation for a practitioner. And what we do in those circumstances is we try to make sure that the decision makers have as much information as possible to make good decisions. However, the case manager, who really is the individual who should be in that role, what we have found is that oftentimes they really don't know what to do when they receive notice. And so what this bill would do is merely direct the Department of Human Services to spell out what the responsibilities are of that case manager when they receive notice. And the extent of the duty, as is suggested in the bill through the Dash One amendments and is in the A version of the bill, is to provide the decision makers with information about the person's preferences and background. It does not substitute decision. The case manager has no decision-making capacity. We're not seeking for there to be any responsibility for what decision is made or how that decision is made. It's merely to assure that the decision maker has good information to proceed with. And with that, I would answer any questions.
Questions? Senator Canope and I met with some hospitals, and I don't know if you've been involved with this at all, but it's related related to this. Regarding people with disabilities and providers, have you run into circumstances where providers are make decisions about whether they should treat a person which the provider feels that is at end of life and the parents want life-saving methods?
Chair Monson-Anderson, as you might expect, these types of circumstances are highly emotional and value-laden. And there can be situations in which there's disagreement about what to do. And that is why the law provides a process to try to come to a reasonable conclusion. We have been... that can be particularly complicated with disabilities. I'll give you an example of a case that happened within the last year in which a woman who lived in a group home and lived with a ventilator was taken to an emergency room because she had a serious infection near her ventilator, where the ventilator went into her body. The physician in that case concluded that this individual did not have the capacity to make decisions for themselves and felt that the infection could not be controlled because this individual kept jiggling their tube. The residential provider believed that this individual could make decisions for themselves and that the act of removing the ventilator, which was what was being proposed, would not be appropriate under the circumstances. And so there was a conflict in that case. And we became involved in order to really be in an advisory role as to what the rules required. And ultimately there was a resolution of the case in that the person remained in the hospital a little bit longer. That their infection, in fact, did resolve, and they returned to the group home. So this is just an example of some of the types of things that can happen in these moments, where there can be there can be different perceptions and conclusions about a person's capacity to make decisions for themselves, and then what is the best course of treatment for a person under the circumstances. So they can be very complicated and sometimes emotionally fraught situations.
In this individual case that we were talking about this morning, one provider at one hospital felt that there didn't need to be any services provided. The parents then took them, the child who's wheelchair bound, to another hospital, and they put her on an IV, and she is now 11 years old, and it's been 7 years since that incident. So we're having the hospitals bring us a report in September on the ethics policy and education of that and communication between providers. It'd be nice to maybe get some of your input too once we have a report from the hospitals to see if you can weigh in on it.
I'd be very happy to do that.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2369. And are you think we can go with this one? Open a work session on House Bill 2369.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2369A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2369A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm going to be a no. I'm just not comfortable with this move. I'm going to need some more time, but so I'm a no at this point.
Okay, any other? Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Sunshine Hayward?
Aye.
Mayor Knoll?
Excuse.
Vice
Chair
Cruz?
No.
Aye. Motion carries, and who wants to carry this one?
Not me.
Well, I guess I'll have to carry this one, too. All right. And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2369 and be gentle with me on questions from the floor. All right. Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, I'm always gentle with you.
All right, all right. Okay. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3021A. Athena.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3021A increases insurers payment method transparency for providers. It establishes criteria for providers and insurers who choose to use virtual credit card payments or other payment options. There's no amendment, and there's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Great. Courtney Dresser, Sarah Basler, Polly DeVore, and Cindy Madden are the only ones that are signed up for this bill.
This bill has a very impressive sponsor list, I would have to say.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association, and I would agree with that impressive sponsor list, so thank you. House Bill 3021A increases payment method transparency for healthcare providers and establishes clear criteria for how virtual credit card payments are made to providers. Virtual credit cards are an electronic form of reimbursement that have been utilized by health plans to pay providers. The virtual credit card payments are sent to providers, usually without any notice or notification, in a form of a number and a PIN number that can be entered into that practice's credit card technology machines. However, transaction is subject to very high transaction fees, sometimes up to 5%. Which gets deducted from the amount of the reimbursement to that provider. And usually, again, without the provider knowing until they swipe that card or use that number. So basically, a provider has to pay to get paid. So there are other forms of viable forms of payment methods that are lower or have fixed transaction costs that are available to providers. So under 3021, what we're looking to do is allow providers to opt in to virtual credit card payment methods if that's what they choose to do. And the insurers will be required to notify the providers of any of these fees that are associated with the cards. It also requires the insurers to offer another form of payment and allow a designee of the provider, like one of these clinic managers that we have with us, to work with the virtual credit card providers, the third-party providers. So that's kind of the basic of the bill. And like I said, we have a couple folks here who are on the front lines and deal with this every day. You can describe the issue better.
Great. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Polly DeVore. I am the director of Olive Branch Family Health. We're a small family practice owned by nurse practitioner Teresa Russell. We are located in northeastern Oregon in Enterprise, Oregon. It's a very rural, small, mountainous community. And our facility utilizes Athena Health, and we're fully electronic. So within that, and being fully electronic, the electronic payments of virtual credit cards are not processable when they come. Number one, they process through to our banking institution, and there's not complete information for that institution to do anything with that card whatsoever. It's attached to an EOB and a link. So for us to even know that that's coming, we have no forewarning. How we find out is because obviously the clinic shows non-payment of that patient's bill. So they have a statement that's automatically dropped that they owe a set amount, whatever it was, that that virtual payment was supposed to take care of. And the patient will then end up calling us saying, well, my insurance stated that they paid that claim. And we start going back through these ugly layers to find what's really at the truth of this. And we usually find that there's a virtual credit card behind it. What the patient will find on their EOB is that it says voucher totals. But we don't see that. In our electronic billing system, it actually will come through and say a check number. There is no check. Our system can process EFTs without any problem whatsoever. You know, we can process credit card payments in the clinic without a problem if we are given the information. These come through with codes that are not supplied. The security codes on the back of credit cards are not supplied. A lot of times the 16-digit code that you would find right on the face of the credit card is blacked out. There's no way to process a payment. And in my personal view, I feel that's fraudulent. You shouldn't be able to state to your policy holder that's paying you for this insurance policy that we paid your claim with a virtual credit card, and they're paying you for this policy, and then the only person that's benefiting is that insurance's bank account, because that payment never was processed. It's sitting in their account. So these claims go, if you can't sort through these multiple layers, which a lot of the electronic health systems can't, it just becomes lost and abandoned. So the only person benefiting from this truly is the insurance company. Again, I would ask that you support this bill. I would ask that we are able to actually opt in, that we're not actually automatically put into this group, that then we have to go through these lengthy phone calls, and it's an endless loop and circle of trying to get to a person to opt us out on a claim. We'd like it, you know, they state that, well, we'll opt you out on blanket claims. It's not. We end up having to make more phone calls when this happens with various patients. Again, there's costs and barriers. Not only is it the fees that are high, but it's also the cost of having staff deal with this. It takes endless hours. The time frame of when a date of service happens to the actual date that you get opted out and a check being sent to you can be a matter of many months. So again, virtual credit cards, there's no transparency from the insurers. It leaves a huge burden on small business, on small practice. This bill would increase transparency by requiring the fees to be disclosed up front. That's something that does not happen. And more importantly, would it require the providers to actually opt in, as I stated. For a practice like the one that I'm a part of, where we would choose to opt, to not opt in, this would save us a huge amount of hassle. I can't even begin to tell you the amount of hours it would save us on the phones. And I hope that you will support House Bill 3021.
Chair Moniz and committee, my name is Cindy Madden. I'm the business manager for practice out of Lake Oswego. We're also relatively small. We have 3 physicians and 5 mid-level providers. We too experience this frequently and find that the amount of time that we spend to try to opt out of this process is excessive. Sometimes just knowing that you have to get your work done, you end up accepting these kind of payments, knowing that the practice is taking a hit on them, and it can be considerable over time. And it really just, our experience in contacting the opt-out options, you know, they just put obstacles in front of us, endless phone systems, silly statements like it's a HIPAA-compliant obligation that they can't, you know, respond to us or opt us out when we know for a fact that has nothing to do with it. When you call them on that and press them to say that that's absolutely, how can that be a breach of HIPAA? You know, then they say, oh, well, it's just company policy. And you're really just working through, and they transfer you over and over and over through phone systems. It really is a frustrating process that medical practices have to devote a lot of time and energy to that takes us away from providing quality care to our patients and having to spend time with administrative processes that really are unnecessary.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. Sarah Baselor on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association, also in support of House Bill 3021. ONA represents several hundred nurse practitioners around the state, a number of whom run their own small businesses like the one that Polly has described. We did an informal survey of some of those practices and asked, how big of an issue is this for you? They responded that they're increasingly seeing virtual credit cards as a form of payment. Again, they don't know that this will be the form of payment prior to receiving it. These cards come with high fees, can be difficult to process and difficult to opt out of. In addition to the costs, there's an administrative hassle that's very burdensome and that also has high costs because of the staff time that has to be invested in that. So I just want to add ONA's very strong support to this bill and urge your support as well. Thank you very much. Great. Question?
I just have to say, when I first heard this was an issue, I about flipped my lid. And it's just ridiculous. How many insurers are doing this? I mean, what percentage of your contracts are doing things like this? Anybody can answer that.
Okay. You know, I don't know about your practice, but ours, we see a trend actually right now in the supplement insurances. Mm-hmm. So your Medicare supplements?
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It appears to be the smaller payers as opposed to the really large local ones. It's not like our top 7 providers. It's the small little independent ones where we might have just 2 or 3 patients. So we are constantly seeing new payers cropping up, and they make us opt out for each and every one of them. You can't just opt out across the board with that third-party vendor. They tell
you. For every single patient.
Correct.
Correct.
And you can't opt out until you've received that credit, virtual credit card, because they identify you through that virtual payment. So you can't even be proactive and just call them and say, I want to opt out ahead of time. You have to actually wait for that virtual credit card information to opt out.
And your best hope is for that specific insurance company that they will opt you out from that point forward. They do not.
Right.
You will be doing that on repeated claims. And if you're so joyous to, as you stated, the HIPAA compliance, my favorite, is they will tell the patient when they call to complain, oh, we need to talk to the provider's office. The provider's office calls and they say, well, you need to talk to the patient. I've actually had conference calls where I've had the patient in my office at my desk and that's how we finally get opted out of one claim.
Unreal. Okay. Thank you for bringing this bill.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on the bill? I know that I did have P-Cell, right? Blankenship is with P-Cell?
No, she's with Pacific Source.
I mean Pacific Source. And they're okay with the bill. No other carriers have voiced any opposition. Do you know of any opposition?
Chair Courtney Dresser again with the OMA. No, we had some discussions on the House side with the insurers, and at the end they said they were fine. So everyone seems to be fine. I won't speak for them, but I will.
Yeah,
and
well,
this time
I've
say
heard
yes.
Too. So I'd like to keep moving on then. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3021. There are no amendments, correct?
Nope.
Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 3021.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3021A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3021A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Senator Shields looks like he's going to.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In abundance of caution, I would like to put on the record that my wife has a practice. She's part of a class that would be affected by this bill.
Oh, yes, Senator Cruz.
I just want to know what Senator Steiner Hayward has in that cup.
Peas.
Oh, it looked like peas.
They're peas.
Already?
Clerk will call the roll.
No, they're dried peas.
Oh, they're dried peas. Okay.
Steiner Hayward?
Aye. Why is that relevant?
It's not.
Excused.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice
Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye, motion carries, and it looks like Senator Bates is a chief sponsor on this, and I will close, so he'll carry, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 3021A, and colleagues, we're adjourned.
Aye.